Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Hang on one second. I want to get you to give a little bit more, because I think you could give us a little bit more with regards to this white homoeroticism of black male athletes. You write, this is on page 49, and again, I think this is deliberately. I appreciate you having this type of candor. You say on page 49, you just be sure to remind him to use a glove when he does that. Okay, gas man? It would be impossible to overstate the degree to which sports talk radio is shadowed by the homosexual panic implicit in the fact that it consists almost entirely of a bunch of out-of-shape white men sitting around talking about black men's buff bodies. I constantly wonder why all the KJR sports talk hosts are so fat, and I have three theories. They have great faces for radio. Like opera singers, they gain weight on purpose to give their voice resonance, or they're just guys who spend all day watching sports, eating pizza, and drinking beer. Now, I'm skipping forward a little bit. This is on page 138. You write, I guess this is a diary entry, February 25th, 1995, Paul emails me, a local spin on a universal theme. A friend of mine confessed to me the other day that when fighting a hair trigger problem while laying his new girlfriend, he tries to fix in his mind an unflickering image of a Peyton Kemp fast break. I'm just pausing for readers. I've never in my life heard anyone reference any sort of erectile dysfunction as a hair trigger problem. That is fascinating. Moving forward.
That's quite common.
I'm just saying, I hadn't heard
it. You need to get out a little more, Gus, I think.
I might need to. Let me finish the paragraph up, and then I'll get your response. So this is right after all that. This is as nothing. Recently, under the covers with Lori, I couldn't quite come. I thought about Charles Barkley saying he likes his teammate Kevin Johnson and that the only difference between them is Johnson likes to attend church while he, Barkley, prefers going to strip clubs. I imagined Barkley at a strip club. Then I came. Now, I was going to stop there, but when I looked, immediately, I mean, if you're just going right down the page, the immediate next paragraph is a very buff black man in a skin-tight running suit was jogging down my block the other day. He goes on to talk about this interaction between this black runner and a bus of middle school children. Passages like these, that's what I mean about this. I mean, it is intense. Like I said, I believe you. This is conscious. This is deliberate, and I'm hoping you can unpack this further to be in a world where I think we agree there is racism, white supremacy dominating the planet, where you have white people who, even like yourself, you admit it, who have this racism, but they enjoy fetishizing these black male athletes. Can you unpack that a little more? For me, that is fascinating. I cannot imagine being in bed with your wife or with a girl, period, girlfriend, whatever, and what helps you achieve sexual climax is thinking about muscle-bound sweaty black males. That is astounding. Can you help me unpack? And it seems like it's not just, it's other people. You're talking about your friend Paul and these guys on the radio. Can you kind of help me unpack that a bit more?
Oh, thank you. I mean, again, you are either the world's best reader of the book or the world's worst reader or some combination of both, but you are definitely are focusing beautifully on the incendiary passages. So I really appreciate that. And you are obviously raising this to a level beyond if the Sonics made the playoffs or not. But, yeah, I mean, I think you've unpacked it pretty well. I'm trying to think of what to add other than...
No, he gave me all the fatherly advice. He was a father before me. You know, Zaire is, I think he's a junior high school, I believe. That's my nephew, so he gave me advice. I mean, one thing that we don't talk about enough is how he gained custody of his kids. You know, an African-American man gaining custody of his sons. You know, we talk about the other stories so much, but we never talk about that side. You know, him gaining custody of his kids while being a professional athlete. Like, that's out of this world, but if it was the other way around, you know, we would love to talk about that. So you know, I'm not done. We need to talk about more of the positives and, you know, and what D-Wade has done, not only for his boys, not only for the city of Miami, not only for this league, not only for Marquette and Robbins, Illinois. It's just, I mean, he's a legend. I mean, let's not deny it.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, December 13, 2018. So I have been told. This is our seventh study session on Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. We're picking up Chapter 3, a little bit towards the end, going into Chapter 4 for today's session. The audio segment that you heard, the first segment, yours truly, Gus T. Renegade, 5 years ago, almost to the day, David Shields, suspected race soldier, was on the program. This is a white male author. He's a professor at the University of Virginia. Incidentally, in addition to being a guest on the program in December of 2013, this was a couple weeks before the Seahawks won the Super Bowl, Mr. Shields did a documentary film about 2 years after being a guest on our program, and he contacted me and wanted me to be a part of his film, and I didn't even respond because I thought to have a race soldier wanting me, inviting me to come be a part of this documentary film. He's going to have the final say with the edits and what I'm saying and what I'm doing in the film. Invariably, it's going to be about supporting racism, white supremacy in some way, shape, form would be my conclusion. So I didn't even bother with it, but that did happen. But David Shields, he's written several books. He was on our program. The book that we talked about specifically was about him following the Seattle Supersonics, who moved to Oklahoma City, I think, in 2009 or 2008, whenever. He followed the team for a whole year. And so he talks about his lust for these black players. You heard some of the passages. I didn't even read one. He had a passage later in the book where he talked about being in bed with his wife, and he was feeling down on himself about something. And then somehow the subject of Gary Payton came up and they had really great sexual intercourse, he and his white wife. But lots of passages like you heard. And I asked him if this was a widespread thing among whites, particularly white males, this homoerotic lust for black male athletes. And he didn't really answer that question directly. Could have been practicing racism. The last thing I'll say quickly before we get started, the second segment, that was LeBron James talking after a game, I think on Monday, Tuesday of this week. The reason I included it was he was talking about Dwayne Wade. They're supposed to be really good friends. They play together. And talking about Dwayne Wade getting custody of his children. And I included that because I think part of that black misandry is that the black rapist sexual beast, you have all this sex and raping all these females. Certainly, you're not being a father. That's not what the black savage male does. He's not a dad. Everyone, Barack Obama, when he was president, everyone comes out to chastise and finger wag at the black male for being a no count. not taking care of his children, you know, dad. And I really appreciated that. And you even heard in the segment, LeBron James being interrupted, him calling attention to the fact that, hey, this is one of the ones that didn't run around and have all these children. He's fighting aggressively to take care of his children. And I'm being interrupted when I'm trying to make my point. Hang on. Same thing I had to do with David Shields. Hang on. I'm not done yet. Hang on. We'll go ahead and get to the man not, Dr. Tommy J. Curry, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one. The super predator is a powerful mythologization of black men and boys, wherein violence and the death of this monstrosity is considered the only solution to its existence. More than a decade ago, the noted critical race theorist Angela Harris argued that gender violence does not produce only female victims. Indeed, since most victims of violent crime are male, it may be that more men than women suffer from greater gender violence. This does not mean that the traditional feminist focus on violence against women is wrong. The gender system operates precisely to disempower women as a class, but this recognition should not obscure the fact that hierarchies of race, class, sexual orientation, and gender itself also mark out groups of men as vulnerable to violence of other men. Police brutality, the establishing of dominance with force, sexual penetration, and, in some cases, death have defined a specific sexual relationship between the dominant white male group and the powerless black male group in America. Many police officers reduce blacks to the status of savages. As with the 19th century edict of the white man's burden, police officers in poor urban minority neighborhoods may come to see themselves as law enforcers in a community of savages as outposts of the law in a jungle. Gendered racism directed toward black males is apparent in the disparity in police killings in this country. While no official database records police shootings, several activist groups began compiling and documenting fatal police shootings by race, gender, and age over the past several years. In all reports, black males are found to be the largest race, sex, victims of fatal police shootings. The first public study of police shooting undertaken by Operation Ghetto Storm in 2012 reported 313 black victims of fatal police encounters. 290 of those killed were black men and 23 were black women. Mapping Police Violence undertook a similar study in 2014 and found 304 fatal police encounters that year. 292 of the victims were black men and 12 were black women. In 2015, the Washington Post began a national online database recording fatal police shootings across the United States in real time. By the end of 2015, the Washington Post reported 248 black males and 10 black females had been killed by police in the United States. By the end of 2016, the Washington Post reported that 233 black Americans had been shot and killed by police. Black men were 222 of those killed. American society not only is generally dangerous for black men, but also uses fatal force to limit the number of black men in the population and control their political dissent. Police killings specifically target black males under the language of social welfare to limit the political will this group can exert within the democratic system. In other words, police violence is an extrajudicial activity that is determined to be necessary by law because these deaths are necessary to maintain the white racial interests the law represents to the majority white population of the United States. These killings are legitimate to whites because the police offer the American public evidence of black male criminality as the rationale for the killings. The American public, secure in its racist sexual tropes of black male criminality and danger, consents to the police as executioners, murderers of black males, because this public is now convinced that the death of black men and boys is necessary for their protection and the security of society. It is this racial consensus among white citizens, American legal institutions, and the police that circumscribes the perilousness of the world black males inhabit. In this world, black males are not men at all. They are sexualized as animal and non-human. Black men and boys are thought to be primitives gazing on the white man as man. The white man then coerces the black male savage into accepting his order, in which black males are made not man through violence and death. The primitiveness imposed on the black male robs him of the potential to ever be innocent. In being defined as savage, he is imagined to be outside civil society. Civilization has escaped him. He is not simply othered, but made non-existent, reconfigured as white masculinity sees fit to justify his subjugation or extermination. He is created by the society and accepted by citizens as a threat to their very existence. He is policed so that order can be maintained. The super predator myth is simply the outgrowth of this rationalization, a shared justification, one accepted by the society at large to legitimate his execution and death. This is not simply a racial issue in the sense that it is only members of white society who see the black male as a danger. It is a problem of how poor black men and boys are defined in the society and how that definition is assimilated and used by all groups and classes distant from the conditions that confine the poor black male within it. The criminalization of black men and boys makes it difficult to believe that they can ever actually be victims of violence. Even childhood cannot protect young black boys from the genocidal logics of American society. As the psychologist Philip A. Goff remarks, black boys are seen as more culpable for their actions, i.e., less innocent within a criminal justice context than are their peers of other races. Because black boys are actually perceived as older and hence more culpable for their behavior, there is an implicit dehumanization that not only predicts racially disparate perceptions of black boys, but also predicts racially disparate police violence toward black children in real-world settings. Police often imagine the black boy, a child, to be physically threatening, the manifestation of the savagery thought to be inherent in his black maleness, a violent beast and predator. The association of black males with animals, specifically apes and monkeys, diminishes our sympathy for their humanity. They are caricatures that increase not only the propensity for, but also the acceptance of, greater levels of violence directed toward them. Goff's implicit bias research has explained that the association between the Negro and the ape is not simply an abstract and detached stereotype. Rather, it is a historical trope used to justify the dehumanization of black people, a method by which individuals and social groups are targeted for cruelty, social degradation, and state-sanctioned violence. Black male death and dying is the result of this engineered societal program, and the machinations of this apparatus obscure and, in many cases, deny our ability to see the lives of black men and boys as worthwhile. Little B is simply one example of the anti-black misandry that targets black men and boys as violent predators. There are verifiably hundreds of thousands more. Even today, the super predator myth persists, materializing itself in the justification for killing black men and boys in broad daylight and before the American public. black males are never victims. Rather, they are violence personified. Michael Brown ran through bullets to assault Darren Wilson. Michael Brown was seen only as rage. He was dehumanized before his murder as nothing more than the violent black male he was thought to be, cast as a superhuman threat to white life. Darren Wilson described himself as a victim of a mythological creature, an overpowering super predator. He saw himself in a life and death battle with an evil entity, and white society legitimized his paranoia as fact. Unlike the assumed psychoanalytic and symbolic references to anti-blackness that find their way into academic accounts of black death and anti-blackness, the death of black men and boys is concrete and real. It needs no translation because dead bodies are lying in streets covered with blood and the perceptible declension of black male flesh. It is obvious, but just as the death of the black male is material, any accounting for the conditions that make his life an impossibility within the walls of the academy is suspiciously absent. Theory cannot imagine him as he is. His corpse is the spectacle that draws whites into conversation with the black scholar. Without this white attention, black scholarship cannot seem to find him because his life is not a subject that brings disciplinary reward. His death, when whites are watching, or when the world notices, now that this is a completely different matter because every black scholar is an expert on anti-black death and the dangers the black male faces. His death remains public and commonly accepted as part of the world. It is seen every day by black academics with little reflection in their work or theories. The scholarship of many black theorists regards the death of the black male without a thought of sympathy. His death is simply ignored, while those who demand his life occupy a central place in our thinking and, more fundamentally, in our theory, are condemned as privileging black male victims above all others. The study of black men and boys must begin with new assumptions about them that appeal to a new audience. The present academic class, black and white, has internalized the same pathological depictions of poor black males that the larger society has. This internalization of hatred for lower class black men, this racist misandry that links criminality, rape, and domination to a presumed savageness, justifies the disciplinary chauvinism against studying them. In other words, the black academic class, like the black middle and upper classes to which they aspire, are able to make a distinction between themselves and niggers through the physical distance and moral condemnation of the lower black male group. This condemnation of the heterosexual black male, the super predator, allows these classes to find commonality with the larger white infrastructure that supports their labor in the academy. Conclusion. The sexually specific reality in which black men find themselves relating to criminality, education, and work shows that the gender category needs to be thought of not as casual, but as focal. In other words, instead of thinking of gender as a category that bodies possess that causes unique disadvantages specific to that category, it would be more accurate to think of what is called gender as the peculiar position many groups have that involves their sexual designation and the societal perceptions of such designations that condition the propensity for disadvantage. Theoretical accounts of sexual disadvantage between groups, or what is currently referred to as gender inequities, would more accurately refer to the accumulation of disadvantage and violence around these groups, not the idea that such violence or disadvantage is unique to or exclusively possessed by said group. It is empirically true that black women also suffer from unemployment and job discrimination, but a different bias affects the black male. This is not a question of denying that both suffer unemployment. It is a question of understanding why black males seem to be affected differently and disproportionately compared with their female counterparts, and a question of why black females seem to be affected differently and disproportionately compared with other populations. This is the point of study, to understand the world and the reality faced by the groups under investigation. Because we do not understand the actual, we conceptualize the imagined and remained trapped by the lullaby of black masculinity as an all-explaining construct instead of letting the evidence before us disclose the complexities of black male life. The territories of anti-blackness, the urban landscape, the feudal geography of the police state all operate to confine black men to such poverty and cycles of abuse and death that theorization is desperately needed to account for the violence, economic, political, industrial, that turns black men and boys into corpses. Black masculinity is conceptually confined by its social result, black death, rather than life. Black masculinity reduces all black males to a disposition, an ahistorical character, to demonstrate their power and abuse their contemporaries. So in theory, black males are simply the less powerful casualties of the violent world they intimately sustain. These patterns of perception, of collapsing death into the undesirability of thinking about the black male, sustains the disciplinary disposition toward black men generally and shows little possibility that these people, humans, lives, can be thought of as more than the cessation of their existence in most people's minds. How we think of, theorize black male death is the primary concern of the next chapter. Chapter 4. Eschatological Dilemmas. Anti-black male death, rape, and the inability to perceive black males' sexual vulnerability under racism. An eeriness haunts the grammar of philosophical discourse on racism that predicates ethical problems and our moral disposition toward black death. Necromancy, which is the result of the death imposed on black male life, and the black academic class's negrophobia, or their fear of being seen as those black males marked for death. Necromancy is as much the result of white racist compulsion, the manifestation of the anti-black phantasm lurking within the mind of the academic that vacates black male life to an absence upon the impressing of pen to page, which is coterminous with his impending black male deaths in society, as it is a problem of thought, whereby the thinking about, the speaking of, black people as living human beings aspiring toward ends in the world is made impossible by the obsession white thought has for the black corpses it creates through rituals of white violence. To write about black men's experience of and challenges to racism is to engage in a reflection that is their anticipation of death. Theorizing about black males involves an existential hesitancy that is grateful for not being that nigger that is to be killed or doomed. The phronesis of the professor, thinker, theorist cultivates distance from that doomed blackness that is associated with niggers. the writing that emerges from the racist appetency of reason seeks to displace the realities of black men and boys in an effort to preserve the illusions of freedom, democracy, citizenship, and personhood. This thinking, in which the deaths seen in the mutilated bodies of black men captured by the state and murdered by white vigilantes, are in the background of our discourse about racism, insists on the need for blackness to be reimagined as more social, an urging that demands the feminization, queering, pluralization of black subjectivity more generally toward a viable living. Instead of inspiring a focused acuity into the nature of white supremacy, these dead men and boys are, in fact, charged with limiting and obscuring our attempts to get at racism and are dismissed as fostering an unproductive nihilism. Because subjects live, aspiring toward futurity, the black male, who is defined by death and dying, is outside subjectivization and morally condemned as an inappropriate source of theorizing about the world. The persistence of black male death in society is behind this disregard, disgust toward black male life, as well as the brutality of ignoring black males' present plight as a subject of study in the academy. The suffering of black men and boys, and ultimately their physical death, breeds fear among black academics. The fear of being mistaken for those niggers marked for death motivates them to run away from, not write about, these black men and boys. This fear is the origin of this disciplinary pathology, the genesis of their negrophobia, is the imperiled existence of black males in society, a necrophobia. Death conditions how black people, and especially how black intellectuals, approach the social reality before them. Death is not simply the finality of some black lives. Death, murder, violence socializes how black people think about the very possibility of life, who is fit for it, and, by effect, who constrains, overdetermines which subjects are chosen to be the representatives through which black life is seen, thought, and written about in text. Every belief in a civil, social, democratic society is involved in denying the severity of black males' suffering because the acceptance of their realities ridicules the conditions and beliefs that one can muster to hope for an improved America. To sustain the normative forces of ethics, democracy, and civility, the black male must be made inconsequential to how theory is formulated. If his condition, both his material circumstances and his death, is regarded as the consequence of black male obsolescence, then the black academic becomes culpable for his marginalization and unthoughtness. For the theorist, the black male has no meaning beyond his physical death. His erasure is a problem that is only compounded by his unpopularity as a topic of academic study and ultimately renders his non-being without remedy. Today, black intellectuals write and assimilate blackness into the categories of disciplines to escape death, real physical death, and attempt to distance themselves from this death through class mobility and social recognition. The black academic class is an aspiring middle class able to observe the dying of poor working class black folk from a distance. In this sense, blackness is written out of the academic enterprise generally and forced into conceptual expressions of convergence and mechanical imitation, while black maleness is ignored altogether and erased specifically, thought of only as pathological, the platform from which other gendered discourses form in reaction. In spite of the world before us, where young black boys, children, are murdered by the state and other white vigilantes for their potential and propensity to become black men, academic writing, the research that writing aims to convey, remains categorically indifferent to the contradictions that black maleness holds in a white supremacist state that not only denies manhood to black men and boys, but also imposes patriarchy on them as seemingly endless and unfettered violence. This patriarchal violence enacted against black men and boys is not only wielded by white men and women, but also actively enforced by the state. To resist the hegemony of these studies, writing about black males is not enough. There must be a reformulating of the terms describing the sexual vulnerability the racialized male endures under patriarchy. Despite the failure of gender scholars to empirically substantiate the claim that the maleness of black men and boys confers privilege within a patriarchal society, intersectionality remains committed to asserting that black male vulnerability is predominantly due to race, not sex. While black men suffer disproportionately more from police violence, incarceration, unemployment, and undereducation than whites and black women, none of their disadvantage is thought to originate from being both racialized as black and biologized as male. In this way, gender theory denies black males the ability to be subjects of study or subjects that offer insights into the sexual racism they experience at the hands of white patriarchy. Liberal arts disciplines and scholars often condemn as patriarchal and disadvantageous to the study of the black woman any research that focuses on black male experience. This erasure of the black male from philosophical and conceptual study is not the result of ignorance or a failure to attend. Rather, it is part of a deliberate effort to displace and eliminate our knowledge of the realities that facilitate the death of black men and the violence against black boys. This casting away of the black male is applauded by scholars and rewarded by disciplines because such disregard maintains the division between disciplinary knowledge and the problem people observed. The poor, violent black males understood solely as objects of study who, ultimately, deserve our moral condemnation. Necromancy, the crisis of speaking to the dead. What does death look like to a black man? Is it a loving farewell of a life lived well, or the regret, the anger he feels for having been allowed to suffer without end from the irremovable blackness that has stained his flesh? Does a black man anguish over not being spared from his life, envious of W.E.B. Du Bois' firstborn? Du Bois' reflection on the passing of the firstborn in the souls of black folk offer some insight into the care and affective relationships black men share with one another through death. While Du Bois celebrated the birth of his son, he feared what life meant for a Negro boy. In recounting the moments after his son's birth, he remarks, "In the land of the color line, I saw, as it fell across my baby, the shadow of the veil. Within the veil, he stood, a Negro and a Negro's son." A mere 10 days after the birth, Du Bois saw the shadow of death come for his child. The fear of losing his baby, of losing his little boy, was quickly replaced with a small but growing joy, as he says, "All that day and all that night there sat an awful gladness in my heart. Nay, blame me not if I see the world thus darkly through the veil, and my soul whispers ever to me, saying, not dead, not dead, but escaped, not bond, but free. No bitter meanness now shall sicken his baby heart till it die a living death. No taunt shall madden his happy boyhood. Fool that I was to think or wish that this little soul should grow choked and deformed within the veil." Death came to rescue Dubois' young boy. It saved him from a life within the veil, within the space of deformation of one's self. Death was an escape from the tragedy of living as a Negro boy. There was something terrible to be avoided in experiencing the world that Dubois felt needed to be celebrated. It was his emancipation from a living death. Black men, accepting their burdens of life, speak to one another with death as the medium of their exchange. Imagine what it means to see this life from the eyes of a black boy, anxious and afraid of a youthful death, but doubtful that he could live long enough to be a black man. Is it possible even to contemplate these ends, and if black male life is this death, this capture within non-being, constantly confronted with its end, what does it mean? What can it mean to speak to black men or write about the black male as living? How does thought, thinking of black men, deal with this reality? If he had a choice to live, would Dubois' son choose it? As a black boy, could he choose life? The repetitive deaths of black men are thought to be inconsequential to how we frame the life and study of this ever-expiring subject. The demography of death and dying represented by homicide rates, suicide, incarceration, poverty, unemployment, and the educational status of this group is thought to be irrelevant in comparison to the political identity projects within the academy. Black maleness is continually marked by de-emphasis. To cope with the loss of their sociality, black men memorialized one another's deaths as escapes from the dehumanization of life. The death of the black male is ignored so that he does not overshadow allegedly more important and deserving subjects. And his corpse, the result of a life gone, a murder that resulted from state violence or societal neglect, is framed as, interpreted as, judged not worthy of note. He is destined to be interpreted by the mother he left, the state he fled, and the world by which he was hated. He is no author. In 1903, Dubois feared that a black boy's life was condemnation. He knew that the tragedies of life might allow one to exist physically as a living organism, but impaled the spirit, the very soul, of the black male. Dubois writes to his son in death as a proleptic vision of the life he will one day enjoy when he, too, dies and escapes the veil. Black male scholars who dare to speak about and study black men and boys as theory-producing subjects beyond their dead corpses are despised by the academy. Their insistence on studying material violence, the complex sexual history of brutalization that presents the black male as a victim of rape and sexual racism, is met with disdain and accusations of essentialism, misogyny, and nationalist ideology. Thus, any study of black men and boys is relegated solely to the empirical, where their failures and death can be assigned numerical value. The black male is forced into a repetitive stasis, his death, incarceration, and poverty described as part of the centuries-long problem of blackness. Described sociologically as the nigger, himself indistinguishable from the conditions of his wretchedness, he is denied the capacity of being a thinking subject. It is asserted that the black male has no place in conceptual thought, since starting with the black male as a thinking subject, as demanding thought, runs counter to his place in the background of other subjects' thinking. He is to be problematized and deconstructed, but never presented as a subject through which we can or should see the world. In short, the neglect of black men and boys is asserted to be a moral necessity, where the scholar is forced to ignore the horror of conditions surrounding the black male to think more abstractly about the lives of others. To choose to write on black males is to accept that you and they are in conversation with death. What do we make of this problem of how we think? How do we write about or anticipate the existence of death-bound entities? Our formulations of ethics, normative values, and presentist accounts all presume that life is the basic condition necessary to conceptualize individuals who represent groups or populations as subjects of thought. The philosopher thinks of ethics, how a rational being ought to act, with the utmost faith in the immediate existence of that individual. But what if that individual resists being thought of because he belongs to a particular group? The being of black men cannot be comprehended accurately in the abstract because black men are constrained and excoriated by the categories used to actually think of them. The routine accounts of racism predicated on whites' aversion to black skin fail to capture the fullness of this generalizable white supremacist predilection because the black male's sexual vulnerability is excised from history. It is not known to most, and even then not as constitutive of the violence the black male undergoes. Because the black male is thought to be empowered by his maleness and the nuance and care needed to understand his peculiarity are consequently neglected, the black male has been the most ignored subject in the attempt to pluralize identities, intersectionality. Seemingly, feminists can use intersectionality to study black and white women and white men in the dawning field of masculinity studies, while black men and boys fall victim to a moral moratorium insisting that they can be studied only as mimetic subjects, always in danger of perpetuating and participating in patriarchy. Robbed of reflective affect, black masculinity is reduced to a hegemonic identity, the still imposing relic of black males' political activism in the black power and civil rights movements. This hyper-masculinity is then read backward, casting every black male figure in history as the archetype for the coming black masculine rage of the 1960s. To date, practically no work has been done to establish the genealogy of racialized death and sexual violence against black men as the basis of understanding black masculinity or the normative endeavors of the black male. Current scholarship on black males focuses unjustifiably on one frame of inquiry, namely the problematizing and reformation of Black masculinity toward more feminist ends. While Black men are said to have agender, they are thought to be disadvantaged solely on the basis of their race. Their deaths are argued to be a consequence of racism, not their maleness, since maleness under the present intersectional calculus supposedly gives them an advantage over women and is thought to be an entitlement of the power of patriarchy. Although white European colonial people gained the power to impose male domination through genocide and slavery, today Black men, the victims of the white settlers' genocidal rage, are thought to be partners in patriarchy's continuing trajectory. This kind of analysis asserts that gender unites all men through a shared masculinity without explaining how non-white men maintain patriarchal desire to dominate across a society torn apart by race and indigeneity and factionalized by class, religion, and sexuality. Patriarchy, a system of white male domination that uses racism, capitalism, militarism, and sexual violence to subjugate the multiple others created as degradations of Western man, has been made possible only through the particular colonial violence and neocolonial economies of white nations and white supremacism. While many gender scholars adamantly insist that gender is socially constructed, its substance and meaning, filled in by history, culture, and context, contemporary academic accounts of patriarchy rhetorically gesture toward social constructionism, but offer little more than biologism, accounts of patriarchy that simply assert that all men, regardless of their race and history of victimization within white empire, pose a patriarchal threat due to their biological designation as male. Gender theorists currently do not hesitate to epidermalize the Black male, chaining his very being to his flawed body, his corpse in death, and morally condemning him using the racist dogmas of Kantian physiognomy, in which one's character allegedly can be intuited from the phenotypes of the body. The Black male is recognized only to be problematized and condemned. He is thereby defined in prolepsis as the already present pathology of his obsessive mimetic lust to be the white manic, regardless of his actual aversion toward white supremacy and his inability to acquire the power and consciousness necessary to reproduce the world as the white father, state, empire. These analyses impose a stillness of mind on the Black male, a pathological dependence asserting that, regardless of knowing the origin of his murder at the hands of the white manic, his own Black death ultimately means nothing to him at all. Black man's dying. The racist sexualization of the Black male in America. Sexual violence against Black men and boys has remained a routine and historically denied aspect of anti-Black racism. In our everyday lives, Black men are publicly assaulted and exposed to the sexual coercion of the police state. Despite the violence that defines their lives under racism, their stories and these public displays of racism's sexual components remain an unapproachable area of study under our current disciplinary arrangement of knowledge, specifically the gender category itself. On January 7, 2014, Darren Manning, a 16-year-old Black boy, was castrated by a female officer who found him suspicious. Manning was a child, a straight-A student. He was searched and patted down, then his testicles were squeezed by this woman of the state so hard that they ruptured with an audible pop. This is not as uncommon as one might think. young black males are constantly subjected to sexual assault and coercion in their daily encounters with the state in the seclusion created on public streets through police interrogation and under the aegis of now unconstitutional surveillance practices known as stop and frisk. On August 9, 1997, Abner Louima, a Haitian man, was sexually assaulted by Officer Justin Volpe in a Brooklyn police station. Louima was arrested for allegedly striking Volpe in a crowd. Once transported to the police station, Louima was forced into a bathroom where Volpe grabbed his testicles, kicked him in the groin, and then anally penetrated him with a bathroom plunger. Showing no remorse, or rather, showing the sexual etiquette of the police state toward black men, he paraded the plunger around the station as proof of his conquest. As Carlisle Van Thompson explains, although fully horrific, Abner Louima's experience highlights the construction of racial difference as a threat to white masculinity, to which ritualistic violence has been an extreme response. Van Thompson is clear. The raping and sexual torture, mutilation of black men is not a new phenomenon. The violence Louima suffered was not isolated to the specific event created by the specific individual, Volpe. The violence he suffered was an imposition of a white's will on his black male flesh. For centuries, racism has materialized through racist erotics imposed on black flesh. The power white society maintains over black bodies can be recognized in the defenselessness the black male body shows in the face of the determined racial narratives whites use to defend the murder, rape, and sodomy of black males for the pleasure of the state and society. Racism is this fungibility, the ease by which the black male body is able to be disfigured and castrated without resistance, mutilated into the mold of the particular white fantasy. Racism is the condition, the property of the flesh that makes it possible for Volpe to so easily translate his desire into a reality on the flesh of Abner Louima. Louima is not a man to Volpe. His black manhood is not male to him. A man-notness that is easily disregarded. In short, although Louima's genitals were left intact, after this savage assault, he may never think about his black body, his sexuality, and his masculinity the same way. Thus, America's white supremacist culture sucks up the shadows of black men, leaving them invisible to the dominant society and often to themselves. Context of white supremacy. First audio segment, Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Nut. We will pick up, we're in chapter four, so the paragraph that we'll start on it, the first sentence is, the sexual violence against and rape of black men is not isolated to the most spectacular incidents. That's the first sentence. Paragraph we'll pick up in chapter four. If you have comments, questions, didn't understand something, something you would like, a question that you would like to pitch to Dr. Curry, feel free. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. You can drop an email as well if you have thoughts as we continue through the book. I think we should have at least 3-4 sessions as we proceed. One question that I wanted to ask, or at least since I have it in front, I guess now it'll be two questions. From where we ended at, the last sentence or so in the book, he's talking about Abner Louima, the plunger situation, where he says, although Louima's genitals were left intact after the savage assault, he may never think about his black body, his sexuality, and his masculinity the same way. Thus, America's white supremacist culture sucks up the shadows of black men, leaving them invisible to the dominant society and often to themselves. What do we make of those last three words, often to themselves, in this context? Question number one. Question number two, given we still have a ways to go, but I mean, we've read more than half of the book, so we should be able to piece together an intelligible thought based on what we've read thus far of the man knot. How do we think this black misandry is manifest in the way that black children are being raised? And this was, I was thinking about this because I think we just played a report within the last 30 days talking about corporal punishment and how a group of whites that I guess they give out regulations or recommendations about parenting, they gave a very stern refinement to make it very emphatic, stressing that corporal punishment should never be used. That not only included physical punishment, but that also included any sort of degrading or verbally abusive language. They said all of that is extremely brain damage. That's what they said. Brain damage can have a extremely traumatic impact in halting the healthy growth of a child's brain. And so I was thinking, well, what do we or do? I'll ask it that way. Do we think black misandry may be impacting how black children are, black boys specifically, are being raised? Do we think that might be impacting rates of corporal punishment, or just how might that be manifested? Because so much of Dr. Curry's text is saying that black misandry is black men and boys. Men, put that in quotes, but black males, older black males and boys. How do we think this might be manifested in how black children, black boys, are being parented? I don't have children. We'll get to the phone lines. If folks have thoughts on those questions or anything else stood out, we will nab you directly. Let us know if things stood out from the text. Let's see. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free if you have thoughts or questions.
Can I be heard?
Let's see. I heard both of you. Let's see. Was that Rob formerly in Wisconsin, now in California?
Yeah.
Good to hear from you, sir. Proceed.
Right. Can you hear me clearly now? Is that better?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So to answer the second question, my attempted black mom was deeply afflicted with a cocaine addiction, and the way I was parented and from the damage that she incurred throughout her journey of life, I feel like she hated me. You know what I mean? And like, I did get the shout out on the compensatory call in. I was listening because of my work schedule. I haven't been able to call in, but I did hear it. And like, it just leads and ties in right into what Dr. Curry is laying out in his text. My mother physically assaulted me before I left. I ended up in the county jail for 3 days. And, I noticed that same trend in the way that I was parenting, like not not just not being nice all the time, like you're dealing with so much stress and the anger and or the frustration comes across in the demeanor. Sometimes you don't even have to be saying something that's like totally mean or like name calling or whatever, but just the demeanor. I seen how that was affecting my children. And just the part about, I think it was Dubois was talking to his son, and he was, you know, just talking about like, man, you know, you'll have a better life. Like once you die, like, man, you know, this journey, man, that I've been on, man, I don't want to really go into it too much right now, but you know what I'm saying, man, for the last, 30 days or so since November 2nd, I've been in the hands of the OFAs, you know what I'm saying? And I'll go more into it on the compensatory call-in or when I have a chance to, you know, really go into it. But I definitely feel like the man not and experiencing just the disdain that comes with being a black male under this system. Thanks for letting me share.
Much obliged, Rob in Wisconsin. Sorry to hear things have been so challenging and unpleasant, to put it mildly, I'm sure. We'll hopefully get the update. But this is total system of terrorism worldwide. Wisconsin, Warsaw, wherever you happen to be, white terrorism. Other caller who dialed in, much obliged for your patience. Did you have commentary?
Yes, sir. Greetings to the callers, listeners, and thank you, Gus, for the platform. This is Cujo out of NYC. The second question I wanted to address, and if I could ask you to reiterate the first one right after, but I'll address the second one, which is during the stages, as far as how I was raised, I know that my mother, single parent household, my mother was attempting her best to curtail a lot of things that were coming outside or that were outside influences in my direction. So she was very strict in that regards. That meant that sometimes she did physically hit me, but I understood as I've gotten older, reading and seeing as a parent myself now, I understand the confusion and why. Also, though, there was a different aspect of it that I really understood as I got older, which was when I came into working in corporate areas in corporate America, they received me in a different way. And because my mother had given me access to books and reading at an early age, my vocabulary was a little bit different. And she would come back to me and tell me that I worked at her job at one point as an intern. And she said to me, she said, oh, yes, the people in the office love you. They think you're very articulate, very articulate. And this just kept on going on and on and on. You're very articulate, very articulate. And it's only obviously as I got older, I realized, oh, it was just because they thought, because I wasn't saying, quote unquote, slang or using so-called slang terminology and communicating with them, which they thought I would obviously do. They perceived me to be somewhat intelligent because I was talking, just something that I understood. And my mother tried her best to shield me, I think, from the negatives of white supremacy, but she also did warn me in many aspects of the fact that I had, and I never forget this, because I tell this to my son till this day, and I'll be telling it to my youngest as well when he's old enough to comprehend, which is you have two strikes against you. You're black and you're a male. There's no escaping it. So be ready to deal with those consequences as you grow older, and you will see. And she hit it on the head. And that being said, I wanted to ask you, what was the second question? The first question you proposed?
The first question was the, let's see, it was the specific sentence where Dr. Curry says he's talking about Abner Louima being abused, and he said, thus, America's white supremacist culture sucks up the shadows of black men, leaving them invisible to the dominant society and often to themselves. Those last three words, often to themselves, what do we think he meant with that?
I think often a lot of times we find ourselves as black males, it goes on a small level and a large level, but I think we subjugate ourselves quite often by being in this system and being confused. We even look at our bodies and ourselves as almost like beasts to be used and abused physically in any regards, whether it be at work, whether it be athletically, or whether it be sexually. In all these regards, we even, to some degree, I think, put ourselves in that category and lose ourselves within it. I hope I'm getting across the point there. But that's my perception of that line. Just some quick notes. I've missed the early parts of the reading, but I have some quick notes just to want to go over. I don't want to take up too much time. On 139, the top, this patriarchal violence enacted against black men and boys is not only widened, wielded by white men and women, but also actively enforced by the state to resist hegemony. Of these studies, writing about black males is not enough. There must be a reformulating of the terms describing the sexual vulnerability and racialized male indoors under patriarchy. And I think I'm glad he did that. It was almost like he basically dropped the solution in there, which is, he's done that a few times as well, but I think I like this one, this term, this phrases that he put together right here, these two sentences, because I think he's announcing that there is a solution for this, but this is the direction that we need to be going. And it means to actually start to get clear definitions of what exactly is happening to black males, not only in this country, but globally under the system of racism, white supremacy. So I really like that line. On 140 in the middle, I don't want to read that. That's going to take up too much time, but this one, at the bottom of us, it says to cope with the loss of their sociality, black men memorialized one another's deaths as escapes from the dehumanization of life. And immediately when I heard this, I thought of almost every rap artist that rhymes and sings about dying. Like, this was the first thought that came into my head. Biggie Smalls, Life After Death. All these artists on and on and on, and then you go around different places all over the globe, and you'll see memorials of black men against walls painted, such and such died here, or such and such passed away, God bless this. Like, just constant, we do it, and I don't even think we realize what we're doing. We do it so subconsciously, constantly in the face of this system that we deal with. And I think a lot of even artists that go out there, a lot of thinkers go out there, and this is what they try to do. They're trying to get past the dehumanization that they've been dealing with in society. The next one is 141, top. The black male is forced into a repetitive state of stasis. His death, incarceration, poverty described as part of the centuries-long problem of blackness. And I think... That's what we get tagged with on a consistent basis. And I think even if a black male were walking down the street or driving a car fancy or dressed well, the mind frame is that this nigger came out of some kind of poverty. So poverty is already attached. And if that black male is not dressed in some kind of acceptable white clothing, if he's dressed in baggy clothing or garments or anything of that nature, he's perceived as probably was some kind of drug dealer or incarcerated or something like that. That's why they dressed like that. And deaf, I think that's self-explanatory. But the end, and I'll leave it this, of that paragraph, to choose to write on black males is to accept that you and they are in a conversation with death. And it's just it's a powerful line, because I too remember growing up in the city here in New York during the crack epidemic in these times, wondering if you're going to live to like 25, like not thinking if you're going to be able to buy a house or a 401k retiring. Those things never cross your mind until you actually reach a certain point and go, wait a minute, I maybe could do that because I survived some of the nonsense that they set up for me, some of the traps. But with that said, I'll mute my line. Thank you for listening. Peace.
Much obliged for sharing. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have comments, questions, thoughts you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Ford.
Yes, greetings, Gus, and greetings to other callers and listeners. Just to answer your first question, what may have been the second, one of them I don't remember, but the question about Louima genitals being left intact after that savage assault. He may never think about his black body again. And then the last part, the white supremacist culture sucks up the shadows of black men, leaving them invisible to the dominant society and often to themselves. You know, I think the culture of white supremacy, as it paints the picture of black males and black people in general, that same effect that it has upon the dominant culture, it bleeds over into, you know, our way of life. You know, I mean, we have the same stimulus. So the media and even literature, Dr. Curry points out later on, it's permeated with, you know, these concepts about, you know, black males and their worthlessness. So there's no wonder that we don't think of ourselves like that. It made me think of, Richard Pryor telling a joke, you know, black man going out one night, police pull him over, have him get out, lay on the ground, bent over, drop his pants, spread his cheek, you know, and after all that's over, who feels like partying after that? He just turns around and goes back home. So that constant bombardment of racism, you know, just affects the way that you view yourself. I'll start with part of my commentary. You know, it was interesting. He was talking about the academic class, both black and white, internalizing the same pathological depiction of poor black males that the larger society has. This internalization of hatred for lower class black men, the racist misandry that links criminality, rape, domination to the presumed savageness, justifies the disciplinary chauvinism against studying them. So the concept itself, you know, causes obstruction to studying black men in a correct framework. And then I think by permeating all of the literature, it has a devastating effect. I thought it was interesting that Du Bois, W.B. Du Bois' reflection on the passing of the firstborn. And one of the other callers mentioned it, but, you know, that death came as a rescue. Deborah's young boy, it saved him from a life within the veil. And Deborah described the veil, you know, earlier. You know, it's a darkening, I guess, even that wording, darkening through the veil. But it's within the space of deformity of oneself. Death was an escape from the tragedy of living as a Negro boy. There was something terrible to be avoided in experiencing the world that Deborah had needed to celebrate. It was his emancipation from a living death. So it's like saying death was better than a life for a black boy living to be a black man. Yeah, and I guess that part of how sexuality is closely related to racism, white supremacy, in those two examples, police officers, the way they sexualize the victims, Darren Manning and Abner Luema. And I think that's about it for me. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Much obliged, Mr. Demifor. Thank you all for responding to the questions. Other folks who dialed in, if you have responses for our questions, thoughts from the book, or anything that did not make sense that you didn't understand, feel free to share. I assume other folks might be getting their notes together or maybe not in position to speak. I will take a moment and share some of the notes that I took, and then I'll check the switchboard again and see if other folks want to share before we get to the second audio segment. The portion that talked about the worship of death, I know one of our first callers mentioned that importantly in worshiping death, black death, on memorializing black death. The section that I read, this was, I think, maybe 2 weeks ago, the section that said, "We acknowledge their position, black males, and like the aristocrats of old, express some regret for their station in life. This class bias from which black people generally, but black males particularly, are observed is saturated with condemnation, not earnestness or understanding." I think that's such a crucially important section, and I pair that directly with this worship of black death. It's ubiquitous. Mr. Fuller, Neely Fuller Jr., man, I thought of Mr. Fuller a lot during the section this week. He talks about this all the time and has for decades, really, in saying that the system of white supremacy makes us death lovers because we don't have an earnest and sincere concern for black people. Mr. Fuller says that, and Dr. Curry is going to say that in the second portion of the text this week. It's coming up. Keep reading. But since we don't have a sincere concern for black people, that it comes out as a sham. It ends up being this really tacky showing often when black people die and let's go get a tattoo of, you know, whatever his name is, or let's go put teddy bears on the fence and go and wail and moan and make a big spectacle at the funeral. And we can, you know, have a blast and go out and do that and do the hashtag thing. But it's tons of black males that are alive right now and we won't help them. Give them a slice of cornbread, anything. Mr. Fuller has talked about that directly. Dr. Curry is going to talk about that directly as well. I thought also with the second question about how black misandry may be impacting how black boys are parented, I thought it was noteworthy, I guess. Mr. Demery Ford, when he was commenting and saying the late Richard Pryor, Cowbell, who had the comedy segment where he was talking about being sodomized by enforcement officers and who wants to have fun after that. I've heard that segment, and if my memory is accurate, it ends him saying, so you leave that interaction and you go home and beat your kids. I think that's how he ended that skit, joke, whatever you want to reference it. That's black parenting under the system of white supremacy. So notes that I took from this week. I thought really important things, sections in the text I thought this week. We said, is it even possible to contemplate these ends? And if black male life is this death, this capture within non-being, constantly confronted with its end, what does it mean? What can it mean to speak to black men or write about the black male as living? How does thought, thinking of black men, deal with this reality? If he had a choice to live, would Du Bois' son choose it? As a black boy, could he choose life? Last two sentences I thought were so important. You can put this in any context. Emmett Till, these are going to be your 14 years. Now, people can say, hey, the March on Washington, Dr. Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speech is on August 28th, 1963, because August 28th, that's Emmett Till, castration, lynching, murder of black male. Rosa Parks, she said what directly influenced her to say, hey, I am not budging. Emmett Till, just castrated, I'm done. I'm going to do more resisting, more fighting back. I'm not going to continue to accept this. I'm going to do a little bit more counter-racism today. She said Emmett Till inspired her. So, I mean, you can, hey, look at how much, you know, has happened and been done and how much you're going to inspire and what have you. So you could choose to take your 14 or you could say, no, thanks, I'll pass. Just thinking about that. Tamir Rice, you could take, what is it, your 11, if you had the choice. You can live and it's going to be 11 years and this is how you're going to die. Or you can say, I'll pass. No, thanks. Living is not going to be good. If I'm going to have to live as a black boy, no, thank you. In a system of white supremacy, no, thank you. Michael Brown Jr., you can get 18 years, go to the crappy school system in Ferguson. And then if you manage to graduate and squeak through, get gunned down in the street and called an animal. That's your 18. You can take it or leave it. Just even thinking about that, I think, is massively important. System of racism, white supremacy. Not that it hasn't been done before, but I mean, I think the slant, I read this before years ago in a book that was talking about, it was talking about this same concept, but with animals, because it was saying that we always privilege the notion that being alive is better. And they were saying, well, wait a minute. If you were in a space where you could choose, now I'm going to be a chicken and I'm going to be caged up with all these other chickens and then I'm going to be eaten and all that. Maybe I choose. No, thank you. I don't want to exist if that's going to be my existence. Just applying that to victims of white supremacy. Next, I think last week someone talked about fungibility and having to look that word up, not really knowing what the term meant. And I thought that was really important. Number one, because I said, hey, there are terms in the text I had to look up repeatedly in the book just to make sure that I knew what the term means. And, you know, am I understanding it correctly as I process Dr. Curry's writings? But fungibility, I said last week that that's a really important one, meaning that the black male, black people in general, but black male specifically, that they do not have a set being, that they can be changed to whatever racists want for the given situation. So when he says racism is this fungibility, the ease by which the black male body is able to be disfigured and castrated without resistance, mutilated into the mold of the particular white fantasy. Racism is the condition, the property of the flesh that makes it possible for Volp to so easily translate his desire into a reality on the flesh of Abner Louima. I thought that was really important, and especially him including the scene about Volt parading around the police station like this is public, like this white sexual fantasy and consumption of black male flesh is not a private affair. Many of these instances are done out in the open, public. What happened to Darren Manning? And Eric Garner said that he had been anally sodomized by enforcement officers, New York's finest, repeatedly out in broad daylight. It's like a public raping of black males. It's not something that you have to be ashamed about, or you have to, you know, go out and find a barn, it seems, for whites. Let's see next. We haven't got that far yet. Make sure I don't get ahead of myself. I did take a few notes that are in the next section. Yeah, I took a few notes that are in the next section, so I'll have to wait a little while until we get there. Wow, lots of good stuff coming in the next section as well. Someone posted on my Facebook page just today something from this week where a black male, I think, settled a lawsuit of some sort where enforcement officers were publicly groping him. Same thing that we just talked about, hands, rectum, genital area, and what have you. And publicly, I think that's really important with the officer in Oklahoma City. I wrote about him. I can't believe I'm forgetting. He had a strange name. He was convicted of raping black females. Daniel Holtzclaw, I knew it would come back to me. Daniel Holtzclaw was not out doing this publicly. He was, you know, going under the cover of night, as they say, and finding secluded places to sexually terrorize black females exclusively. A lot of these incidents where black males are being violated, these incidents are happening publicly. This is like, whoopee, gather around. It's time to rape the black male. Yes, time to slice off a coon's genitals. Let's gather the whole town around. This is a bonding. I'm hopping ahead. I'll hush because I'm hopping ahead. Other folks, if you did not get a chance, anybody that we missed completely, not had an opportunity to speak at all, anybody we missed? Thomas in New York.
Yeah, sure. Peace to us. Peace to all the callers. Peace to Ross. You know, I was watching a movie. Everyone's probably seen this movie. And I watched it on couple of days ago, and I've seen it a million times, but so many of the black male concepts that Mr. Dr. Curry is putting out there in his books or was in this movie, and the movie was The Color Purple. There was a scene where all these, you know, Oprah's character had this white woman come up and kiss her kids and say, "You want to be my maid?" And she's there with all these black men. And I mean, it was like these black men just wanted her to shut up. And, you know, she hits the man and, you know, you saw what, you know what happens next there. But it was, you know, pretty interesting that, you know, those black men all knew they couldn't do nothing to defend her in that situation, even though at the time they were outnumbering her. Another part where black male patriarchy at the end where his father is telling him, "Boy, you gonna let this woman talk to you like this at your dinner table? You a man," you know, like, you know, I mean, you know, we have that patriarchy concept, but, you know, it's not really true. So there's a few other parts, but man, all these concepts that he's gonna put in his book is in there. I'm about to die, so I'm gonna try to go through this real fast. I think the concept of black scholarship and black scholars or black academia is a huge form of white validation. I put black scholars on par with the first blacks or people with white friends. You know, they're, I mean, why would you want to? Either way, I'm not quite Area 8, but it's up there. I think his criticism of black scholars and black scholarships was reinforcing white validation, every point of it. I don't think you could have black scholars under a system of white supremacy unless you tell me who makes them scholars. I need to re-listen to another section because there were some things it seemed like he was emphasizing that maybe a lack of academia on black men. And if that was for black people to see, I agree. I have to catch the context. I don't even want to talk on it. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Other folks, if you have any comments you want to make sure you get in before we get to the second audio segment, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. So glad. I almost forgot this. One portion that I forgot to include, I had marked it earlier. I marked it before today. I rarely highlight in advance of the broadcast. This one I did. Dr. Curry writes, make sure I try to give as much context as I can. The writing that emerges from the racist appetency of reason seeks to displace the realities of black men and boys in an effort to preserve the illusions of freedom, democracy, citizenship, and personhood. This thinking, in which the deaths seen in the mutilated bodies of black men captured by the state and murdered by white vigilantes are in the background of our discourse about racism, insists on the need for blackness to be reimagined as more social, an urging that demands the feminization, queering, pluralization of black subjectivity more generally toward a viable living. I thought that was really important. Folks, have any thoughts on last sentence in particular? I know it's a little lengthy. I'll read it again slowly so that we can all process and think. This thinking, in which the deaths seen in the mutilated bodies of black men captured by the state and murdered by white vigilantes are in the background of our discourse about racism, insists on the need for blackness to be reimagined as more social, an urging that demands the feminization, queering, pluralization of black subjectivity more generally toward a viable living. What do folks make of that passage?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Assessing it the way my perspective is on that passage. It's almost like saying that in order for us to be somewhat viable, it's almost as if they would prefer us effeminized. And this would, I mean, from my perspective, this makes sense based on the fact that even I remember listening to Nellie Fuller speak about this, stating how black males and females that were homosexual or anti-sexual, we should say, were like the first blacks to get jobs. Like they didn't have any problem working or getting work in white establishments more than before anybody else. And that today still holds true. Because I work in corporate America and I see it. I see it where myself, I go through quote unquote difficult times because of the fact that I'm not quote unquote compromised in their eyes. So the ones that are effeminized, they get treated like they just get treated better. And that's kind of what I take from that text. I take that that's the push that the society would rather see. I could be a little bit off, but that's what I'm gathering from it. My line.
Much obliged, good sir. Any other thoughts on the passage?
Yes, we'll have you heard.
Mr. Demery Ford?
Yes, I think that in that passage is the solution, if I understand it correctly, is that it seems like the beginning, a part of the origin, is the image that black men have been given, or the lack of concern, you know, and humanization towards them. So if you like his book now bringing attention to what's happening to the black male, then you can begin to humanize him. And then if you can get these theories recognized, then we can start to make some progress on humanizing black males that may eventually bring some change as far as the murdering of unarmed black men in the street. That's my take on it. But I wanted to mention something I heard in the reading earlier, something about blacks being referred to as animals and savages. And I thought about on the 12th, the black PG County Black Officers Union and another non-white union came together on the racist policies and tactics that the Prince George County administration is doing. And some of the things is name calling of the residents and neighbors as coons and whores, and even fellow officers as apes and monkeys and this sort. So that same scenario has been played out today. And one other incident, a young woman had her baby. She was at some food service outlet, and the police was called. And so they asked her to leave. When she wouldn't leave, they took her to the floor and started to yank her young son from her arms, and it looked as though they were going to yank the sockets out of the young kid's arms. And one of the passages here, underlined, I can't find it now, but it's about, you know, the system don't care about the age of a child. Black males are, you know, treated with disregard, regardless to the age. Being a child or an infant does not give you any leeway. So I mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks.
Negras are negras, regardless of age. Negras are negra. I think that's one of the major points in the book with black boys. They are raping negrists in waiting. So, you know, negras are negras. Any other comments folks wanted to make sure they got in, responses to any of the questions or any other passages stood out before we get ready to shuffle on to the second audio segment? Everyone satisfied? First audio? Grant, make sure I did not miss out on any of my own notes from the first section either. Lots of good stuff coming up in the second audio segment. James Baldwin, some of the highlights that I had already made, I was looking forward to sharing will be coming up. So even more goodies to get in. Let's see, got that. Oh man, I did miss out some really important ones. One other one. He says, death, murder, violence socializes how black people think about the very possibility of life, who is fit for it, and by effect, who constrains over determines which subjects are chosen to be the representatives through which black life is seen, thought, and written about in text. Every belief in a civil,
social, democratic society is involved in denying the severity of black males' suffering because the acceptance of their realities ridicules the conditions and beliefs that one can muster to hope for an improved America. I thought that was really important because if I'm interpreting this accurately, if we were talking truthfully about the condition of black males, all of the nonsense about progress, every time we've made so much progress, things are so much better, this is the best place, you niggers have it, all of that would be nonsense. And it even seems to be a hope for improvement, because he says specifically, every belief in a civil, social, democratic society is involved in denying the severity of black male suffering because the acceptance of their realities ridicules the conditions and beliefs that one can muster to hope for an improved America. I don't like using the term America in that context, but at least in my view, extremely important passage in the text. Everybody involved in lying about and minimizing particularly the suffering of black males. I would say black people in general, just my view, but everyone, every belief in civil, social, democratic society involved in denying the severity of black male suffering. I will stop there. If everyone is good, we'll get to the second audio segment. So we are in chapter 4, but we're very early in chapter 4. So if you have audio segment, or if you have notes, thoughts from the first audio segment that you did not get a chance to share, just make a note, anything that we touched on or what have you, we should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. So we will be sure to bring you in immediately. Again, this is Dr. Tommy J. Curry, The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood, audio segment number 2. The sexual violence against and rape of black men is not isolated to the most spectacular incidents of our recollection. Black men live under the constant threat of rape and sodomization from police. On August 28, 2004, Coprez Kofi was stopped by Officer Scott Korhonen and Officer Gerald Lodewich. In an effort to find drugs, Korhonen stuck a screwdriver in Kofi's anus. Even when white officers assault other non-white people, there is an association with the sexual violence committed by the police with black men. Angel Perez was raped to make him submit to being an informant. In October 2012, the Chicago police anally penetrated him with a pistol, with one officer yelling, "I hear that a big black nigger dick feels like a gun up your ass." The sexual violence of the police is not isolated to the act of sodomy. The fear that white men have had of the black rapist, the mythical beast conjured within the white imagination to justify lynching, also serves as justification for violence against black men. On September 16, 2013, the white state replied to a 911 call by a white woman fearful of a black man, Jonathan Farrell, who was injured and bleeding from a car accident and simply seeking help. The woman's fear led to Farrell's execution by the white men of the state. Mere contact with the police is an opportunity for black males to be sexually assaulted. In 2013, Andre Little was hit in the scrotum with a taser by Officer Christopher Tong for refusing to move to a different train platform. On December 20, 2015, a 33-year-old black man named Corey Green was attacked by police. He underwent surgery to restore blood to his testicles after a cop stomped on his groin with a boot, crushing his scrotum. These are not isolated violations of black men. We often think of black males being victims of racism and only in the most extreme circumstance being sexually violated. This is, in fact, racism as it affects all black males. Sexual violence, rape, is the imprint of racism on the flesh of the black male in America. My analysis is not meant to convey to the reader that the rape of black men only occurs at the hands of the state. For many black men and boys, white vigilantes, everyday white citizens, become their potential rapists or murderers. The death of Trayvon Martin has been discussed by intellectuals, media pundits, criminal justice experts, and social justice activists exclusively as a narrative of race-based violence. While it is nonetheless true that Martin's death has served as a grim reminder of anti-black violence, there has not been one article, blog, or public conversation dealing with the possibility of Martin being sexually assaulted by George Zimmerman, despite Rachel Gentile's announcing to the American public that she told Trayvon Martin that Zimmerman could have been a pedophile. On January 10, 2013, two young black men were strangled by four white assailants in Joliet, Illinois. Two white women and two white men killed Eric Glover and Terrence Rankin, surfed on the top of their bodies, and then had a threesome on their corpses. This story received little national coverage and to this day remains untouched by the literature or problematized as a racist act of sexual violence against black men. Even when black males are raped and killed by white men, as in the case of the murder of Deion Payne, rape charges are rarely sought against the white perpetrator. Despite testimony from an eyewitness describing how Payne was beaten, robbed, and anally penetrated with a rod by Michael Watson, there was no conviction for or even acknowledgement of Payne's rape. Black males, even as children, are denied the capacity to be seen as sexual victims. Racism, taken only to be the hatred of one's skin color, erases the sexual vulnerability that black males historically have endured at the hands of white men and women. In short, the erotic nature of black male death is denied to maintain the stability of our disciplinary categories. Academics, scholars, and policymakers find comfort in alienating the homoeroticism and sexual fetishization of black male flesh. In doing so, racism remains an accident among civilized societies rather than the barbaric sexual lust whites have for the anal penetration and castration of the black male body. Under our intersectional norms, black male death is viewed as generic. It is normal, a routine and repetitive occurrence. Categorically, it is simple. A base property of race denied subjective, gendered, sexual uniqueness. Politically, black men's and boys' deaths have been morally condemned as heinous acts of racism, but dealt with as little more, rarely thought to need or be worthy of subjective theoretical explanation. Such disciplinary, intersectional logics erase the full lives and experiences of these black men and boys as people and reduces our understanding of them to their deaths. In the mind of the black intellectual, the academy, these black men and boys represent numbers, the examples with which to start the conversation, not the loss of a full person, a productive human. Let me be clear. This erasure that accepts the normalcy of black male death simultaneously accepts the racist disposability of black male life. Our present theories used to analyze the racial oppression of black men, the act of theoretical interpretation leave black men to be understood primarily by their dying and, in consequence, allow their deaths to be weighed against other political interests or more ideal subjects. Dehumanization finds its extremity in making the lives of the oppressed inconsequential. It is not being able to think of the black male beyond his corpse that is the real result of racism's dehumanization. Racism thingifies black life and the reduction of black men and boys to the event of their dying leaves the aim of racism, accepting the racially oppressed as not human, nothing lost, unquestioned. Making the suffering of black men and boys a second thought, weighing it as less valuable because it is so common, saying, maybe he should not have died, but is not a statement affirming the lives of black males. The deaths of black men and the lack of a category or the empathy to understand the fullness of their suffering in a racist society empower others to interpret their lives for them, which has the effect of lessening them in death. Because black men die and because black men are decentered as the normative subject of thinking, there is a collective forgetting that collapses our understanding of them to their corpses and not their life's activity. We do not know what these black men were or what these boys wanted to be. We confine them to our example of racism or yet another one. The killing of black males has always involved an erotic obsession with their black flesh. It stimulates the lust of whites, their appetite for scarred and lifeless black male flesh. The reality unfolding outside the academy, in the actual world where black men and boys are being executed, has shown no regard toward the intersectional morality of the university or the gender reductionism of disciplines that continue to excise the experiences and deny the horrors inflicted on black men and boys for the sake of theory. This is why the actual deaths of black men and boys shown to us publicly are found consistently to exceed the categorical limits imposed on black masculinity through the category of race and denied under the category of gender. The categorical abstractions of race, class, and gender used to analyze and, most worryingly, decide what is perceived or able to be interpreted concerning black masculinity deny the sexual motivation behind racist violence against black males. Even worse, these categories mythologize an a priori theory of gender rooted in the relationship of white maleness to white femaleness and assert through analogy that any asymmetry between black males and females is ontological. What follows from this asserted calculus is that black men are benefactors of a sociologically established privilege given to them through their maleness by a historically white patriarchy. Through moralization, black masculinity is de-emphasized, found guilty of some conceptual offense. Even when the observer is tasked with examining the fleeting lives and seemingly inevitable deaths of black men, current gender theory demands that the observer impose erroneous historical mythologies to justify the hierarchy between the male and the female demanded by theory. This forces scholars, students, and the public to offer superficial analyses of black male death because our current theories are capable of only narrow racial accounts of the vulnerability from which black men and boys suffer. Our theories deny that anti-blackness involves racist erotics that peculiarly affect black male bodies, consequently triggering the murderous predilection of whites. The black male is thought to be a shadow of sorts, a transmutable horror formed in the mirage of the onlooker's most dreadful thoughts. This nightmarish creature that we call the black man is found throughout the Western world. Legend asserts that the black male transforms into the worst fears of his onlookers upon their recognition of him. He is known as death, rape, murder to all but himself. James Baldwin once said, "To be an American Negro male is also to be a kind of walking phallic symbol, which means that one pays in one's own personality for the sexual insecurity of others. To be black and male, then, is to have one's social genesis, the body through which one is recognized, rooted in caricature, its transfiguration as a phobic entity, a living schiaphobia. The white man's fear of black men does not impede his excitement or the stiffening of his penis in his murderous encounters with black men and boys. The body is the site of understanding the being and intent of the thing in Western epistemology. The primacy of sight, the focus on the visual entity, has been the basis of Western thought since Immanuel Kant's racial geography and use of physiognomy to perceive the interiority of man from exterior facial and phenotypical features. Under these racial deductions, the recognition of racial and sexual difference demands that an intent be assigned to the body perceived by the white observer. In the case of black men, these logics create phobias to rationalize the killing and use of those bodies. Under this somatic epistemology, recognition is as prevalent as phobia in the knowing of others, especially racialized male others. Baldwin's analysis of white men's homoerotic lust for black men's death. The phobic obsession white men have for the castrated corpse of the black male body is illustrated to great effect in James Baldwin's Going to Meet the Man. The opening lines of Baldwin's short story transport the reader into the bedroom of Jesse, an impotent sheriff, frustrated by his inability to fuck his white wife. Baldwin intentionally shows the reader the intimacy between a white man and a white woman to demonstrate how the black male is the sexual aspiration of whites. They want to fuck like him or be fucked by him. The black phallus sexually arouses them. The white man wants to possess it, while the white woman yearns to be penetrated by it. Despite Jesse's best efforts, he is not able to obtain an erection through his fantasies about women. He stroked his wife's breast. He did not respond. He thought of sex with a nigger girl, the ones he would pick up or arrest, and while the image of a black girl caused a distant excitement, his loins longed for something stronger, more erotic, more sexual to ignite his libido. Jesse then began to think of niggers, how dangerous they were. Even a black girl you were fucking could kill you, despite making believe you made her feel so good. Jesse thought niggers were ugly and smelled. He hoped to never again feel that filthy, kinky, greasy hair under his hand. He hated them. They were animals. They were no better than animals. What could be done with people like that? Here they had been in a civilized country for years, and they still lived like animals. Their houses were dark, the smell was enough to make you puke your guts out, and they sat a whole tribe pumping out kids, it looked like, every damn 5 minutes. Jesse's racism took him to a particular scenario where blacks were surrounding the courthouse to register to vote. The leader of the protest was captured, and Jesse's friend, Big Jim C., and some of the boys really had to whip that nigger's ass today. Because the black protesters would not disperse, they were targeted for violence. They took the ringleader to the cell. He was bleeding from his ears, a sign of his truculence. They prodded this man, even in his testicles. The amount of violence his body withstood led Jesse to conclude, "This ain't no nigger. This is a goddamn bull." As the black man's body laid almost lifeless on the cold floor of the cell, Jesse remembers he had met this man as a boy. As a boy, he addressed Jesse as white man and told him that he would respect his grandmother, Mrs. Julia Blossom. The boy told the white man he would no longer call his grandmother Old Julia. This resistance from a nigger angered Jesse. He wanted to pistol whip him until the boy's head burst open like a melon. The singing of blacks outside the jailhouse protesting the violence of the white police on the black man overtook Jesse. He felt an icy fear rise in him and raised him up, and he howled, "You lucky we pump some white blood into you every once in a while. You're women." This horror, the anger and disgust he felt towards the nigger made him have another reaction. His fear drained him. He was abruptly almost too weak to stand. To his bewilderment, his horror, beneath his own fingers, he felt himself violently stiffen with no warning at all. Baldwin draws the reader to the unacknowledged sexual attraction the white man has to violence against black men. To some, Baldwin's story seems merely fiction, but he captures the desire, structurally concealed but present, that inspires white men to want black men dead. While our accounts of violence in the academy range from marginalization to silencing, sexual violence has been reserved only for the imagining we have of rape. Baldwin suggests this is much too limiting. The white man learns of himself through the death of the nigger. Just as puberty is the biological development of his sexual capacity, so too does it open his mind to sexual fantasies, one of which is the murder of the black male beast and the possession of his big black cock. Jesse lusts for the sight of the bleeding, almost dead black male body. It is pornographic, produced by his own hand. His creation, killing black men, gives white men power to create their fantasies in the world. Jesse remembers this horrific arousal, the stiffening of his penis from the sight of an almost dead nigger. He remembers it because he felt it for the first time when his father took him to his first lynching. Jesse remembers that the white mob was in awe of the naked nigger hanging from the erected foundation. There was no hair left on the nigger's privates. He remembers the sexual arousal of the crowd, specifically the arousal he saw in his mother. He watched his mother's face. Her eyes were very bright. Her mouth was open. She was more beautiful than he had ever seen her, and more strange. He, like his mother, was mesmerized by the sight of the suffering, bleeding, naked, hanging black man. To him, the gleaming body was the most beautiful and terrible object he had ever seen till then. There was an allure to killing and castrating a nigger that Jesse understood even as a young boy. A friend of his father held the knife that would inevitably be used to castrate the lynched black man. Jesse wished that he had been that man. The man with the knife walked up to the hanging black man. He took the nigger's privates in his hand, one hand, as if he were weighing them. Even as a boy, Jesse eroticized the black phallus. Jesse describes the black man's penis and testes as though they were to be found only in his personal fantasies. To him, the nigger's privates seemed as remote as meat being weighed on scales, but heavier, too much heavier. This realization made young Jesse's scrotum tighten. Jesse could think only of its size. It was huge, huge, much bigger than his father's flaccid, hairless penis, the largest thing he had ever seen till then, and the blackest. The white man with the knife, his father's friend, stretched them, cradled them, caressed them. This was the moment the crowd had gathered to witness. The knife flashed, first up, then down, cutting the dreadful thing away. The lynched man was now castrated. The blood came roaring down. The white mob attacked the now dickless and dying black man. They tore at his body with their hands, with knives, with rocks, with stones, howling and cursing. Jesse's recollection comes to a close as he takes his father's hand, walking away from the charred body. The head was caved in, one eye was torn out, one ear was hanging. What was once a black man was now just a black, charred object, lying, spread-eagled, with a wound between what had been his legs. Jesse feels something rise within him. His libido returned as he thought of the boy in the cell, the man in the fire. He thought of the knife and grabbed himself and stroked himself, and a terrible sound, something between a high laugh and a howl, came out of him. He grabbed his wife, whispering to her, "Come on, sugar, I'm going to do you like a nigger, just like a nigger. Come on, sugar, and love me just like you love a nigger." Through castration, the white man takes possession of the black phallus. He dominates the black man and the mythological power of the nigger dick. He is able to fuck his wife. He is a man because his whiteness, civilized, reason, order, can temper the nigger's savage sexual potency. His manhood is thereby defined in overcoming the bestiality he imagines to be symbolized by the black phallus. David Marriott understands Baldwin's Going to Meet the Man similarly. As an origin story of white masculinity, the generational inheritance of white patriarchy through the castration of the black male, Marriott observes, fucking his now nigger-loving wife, savoring the inheritance of the paternal secret, Jesse knows that what he had witnessed was a gift from his father. That gift, the desire and power to castrate, to take, and so to take on the sexuality of black men, brings them together and forges their futures as white men. Disconcertingly, what sustains Jesse and his wife as he labored and she moaned are the correspondences between that gift and the terrible, gaping wound. Marriott makes apparent that Jesse's necrophilia, his sexually murderous lust, thrives on imitating derogatory images of black men as either dangerously oversexed and or emasculated or dead. The white boy is made a man through the destruction of the black male body, his conquering of the black male beast. He is made the white man through his castration of the black man and through the use of the black phallus as his own. As with Eldridge Cleaver's description of the omnipotent administrator, it is the immateriality of the white man, his aphysicality, that creates the drive to dominate and embody the hyper-physicality of the nigger. This is why he wants to fuck like a nigger, to sexually satiate his white wife. As a white man, he is enabled by reason to fuck a white woman like a nigger, to satisfy what she craves without raping her. Murder, the death of the black male body, is the ritual of transference for white men. As with the charred body left in the wake of his first lynching, Jesse believes that he can embody, through castration, the sexual potency of the black male. This embodiment allows him to overcome his sexual lack, the hereditary inadequacy and flaccidity of his father's white penis. The white man who murders the black man attempts to be man, since he has shown the superiority of being the white mind over the black male body. Killing black men is an attempt to reduce the number of black phalluses that can cause white men anxiety and worry. The death of black men arrests the yearning white men have for their flesh and phallus. They remove the penis to signify their domination of the black male body, thus making him a lifeless corpse and not man. Baldwin's elucidation of the multiple levels of sexual desire and objectification that motivate the murder of and the pleasure obtained from murdering black men destabilizes the very idea of a shared maleness with white men that can be thought of as a history of patriarchy. Baldwin describes white masculinity as dependent on the castration and death of black men and boys. This speciation between racial males and white men disrupts the unified narratives of privilege and masculinity by differentiating the histories of black males, their reactions to the sexual violence they survived, from those of white men. Baldwin's insight is restated and slightly updated to address the intersectional paradigms of our current era in Darren Hutchinson's work in Post-Intersectionality. Hutchinson rejects the idea that maleness or male privilege can be ascertained through the gender component of intersectional analysis. Such categorical delineations based on gender are untenable because there are heterosexual stereotypes that inform the sexualized racism endured by all people of color.
under racialized systems of oppression, gender was not categorical, but situational. Black males were deemed rapists and killed with this stereotype, serving as the justification. Black women did not suffer under such a label because they were, in fact, women, and for much of history, deemed incapable of rape. Hutchinson points out to intersectional theorists that their categorical accounts of race and gender are far too simplistic to actually capture the multiple dynamics and histories involved in black maleness. Lynching, for example, was frequently justified through a racist, sexualized rhetoric that constructed black males as heterosexual threats to white women. Thus, heterosexual status, typically a privileged category, has served as a source of racial subjugation. This history complicates the apparent stability of privileged and subordinate categories. The meanings of these identity categories are, instead, contextual and shifting. Like Baldwin, Hutchinson understands that all racism is erotic and sexual, which means that there is no one body or history to which gender can solely refer within an intersectional matrix. To simply ignore or decentralize the sexual racism suffered by black males to contort their realities into maleness or patriarchy so that the intersectional critique seems urgent simply continues the sacrifice of black male life to caricature for political and disciplinary convenience. History simply resists such reductionism given the actual oppression and sexual violence that black males suffer. When a black boy is raped, his rape is exceptionally confounding because rape is thought to be the province of the female body and thought not to be possible, much less actual, when related to the male body generally and to the black male body specifically. Rape is never thought to be a desire inspired by the black male body. His hyper-masculinity, his savageness, is thought to make the rape of the black male brute an impossibility. As discussed in Chapter 3, the black male can only be and is only thought to be the rapist. But exceptionality is not a comment on the oppression of the black male. It is only a commentary concerning how other interpreters who are not black males see and think about the black male body. If violence matters, if erasure matters, if the accuracy of understanding the lives of black men is the aim of study, then we must concede that we are not liberating people in reality when we deny aspects of life that do not align with academic theories. Not assigning gender or sexuality to black men does not mean they do not suffer from sexual violence. What this refusal to see shows is that there are external disciplinary problems of knowledge that refuse to acknowledge the violence in their lives in pursuit of other, less liberating interests. Erasing the sexual violence against black men is not only a political blindness, it also has its origins in the categorical arrangement of knowledge that makes sexual violence and rape the province of female vulnerability, not that of males. Black women were raped during slavery, so the sexual order of race and gender, even today, is thought of as an extension of these antebellum logics. Black men, however, are denied such an account of their racial and sexual vulnerability, even though they are raped, castrated, and anally penetrated according to the same logics. Denying the rape of black men, their sexual assault at the hands of white men and women, is a product of the heterosexual framing of slavery, a denial that asserts that white men were the rapists and black women were their only victims.
This denial began in our imposing of the categorical arrangements of gender, which fixates on the feminine and neglects the power of anti-blackness to denature the assumed hierarchies between men and women. Being white allowed white men and women to sexually assault and define black masculinity in America. The sexual attraction to and sexual abuse of black men and boys, this unimaginable violence emerged from a collapsing of gender itself because the rape of black men and boys was in excess of the sexuality of the day. It had to remain hidden to protect white manhood and allow white womanhood to remain immaculate. This, however, is a historical problem.
And that's where we will stop for this week. We'll pick up next week. We'll be on the subheading on Thomas Foster's The Sexual Abuse of Black Men Under American Slavery, engaging Sadia Hartman's Scenes of Subjection, on the basis of the raping of black men during slavery. That'll be next Thursday. If you have thoughts, questions, comments, number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Any folks, if we missed you totally, like you didn't get to share at all the first time that we swapped views, you should definitely get your hand up now. We will get to you first to make sure that you are not left out of the discussion. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Yes, Robbie here.
Mr. Demery Four.
Yes. I was listening to one of your guests. It was Carolyn West, I believe. You know, she came on and was talking about pornography. And I think you even mentioned before that the interracial of pornography was like a $1 billion industry. So with all of the white people that are here, it's what they want, you know, and what their desires are. So it is mostly them that want to see these certain types of pornography. And then when it comes to black women, she was saying that they are in the most degrading parts of pornography, and even mentioned, you know, one of the movies. And it was strange. I was talking to another a black male that was visiting from New York, and he mentioned that pornography movie that she talked about, The Ghetto Gaggers. And I couldn't believe it. He was mentioning it like it was something that somebody should see, you know. And I was telling him, man, I was just reading a book that said that's probably the most offensive pornographic movie, you know, made in the last couple of decades, man. And you sitting there saying, you know, something good about it. I mean, she's described it as totally disgusting. So we can't deny that that racism is closely related to sexuality or the sexual terrorism of black people. And this particular reading, you know, went in specifics, you know, that, you know, you sort of had an idea that there was something really weird and strange going on in the minds of whites, and it's particularly white men, you know, when it comes to their desires for black men and the hatred that they have for them. And that particular incident where they described the lynching and the castration, you know, no matter how many times you hear about it, and but to hear it described in graphic terms, it just, you know, it has a devastating effect. This book has also mentioned one lynching earlier in the book that I was reading about, that it happened within 25 miles from where I was born. And what was particular about that particular lynching is that it was a long-term relationship between a white woman and a black man. But then when they decided to lynch him, of course, she was in it saying that he raped her, but she was the one that lit the, they burned him at the stake. And she was the one, his longtime lover, years of screwing this white woman, and she lit the stake, you know, where the guy was burned at the stake. So that was pretty devastating. The fact that, you know, I grew up my entire childhood there, I never heard anything like that, and no one was mentioning it in that particular area. I think it was, it had to be close to, you know, 100, maybe not 100 years ago, but maybe 70, something like that. But, you know, no mention of it. So it's almost like they do these things, and over time, you know, it just becomes something of a, you know, novelty, so to speak. But I'll mute my line on that, Gus, give somebody else take a chance to talk. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a word to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. With the second segment, I really, the main point that I really appreciate about the book is it really helping me to better understand the rape dynamic that black males face from white women. I kind of already understood, even when I was a little bit more confused, that white men could rape black males, but not even understanding the true sexual vulnerability that black males face at the hands of white women, and even the story that Mr. Demery Four was sharing, and just how, you know, it might have not been a relationship, because if this black male were to say no, just, I guess it was a couple of, I think it might have been the, maybe the segment or a couple of segments ago, how the story of the black male who was married and the white woman saw him out with his wife, and that didn't matter. She still wanted him to, you know, be his sexual victim. So it's definitely helping me to better understand the victimhood that black males face. I definitely, I never read any of James Baldwin's work, but it definitely, the passage about Jesse the sheriff, it definitely interests me to finding out more about James Baldwin. And I like how Dr. Curry, he uses the term thingifies. I forgot what page it was on, because I have the book. I can't even find it. I think it was before the story. Okay, it's on page 145. I just have the paperback book, where he says, racism thingifies black life and the reduction of black men and boys to the event of their dying leaves. The aim of racism, accepting the racially oppressed as not human, nothing, lost, and a question. So I think that sentence is really important. I think it really ties together everything that that, you know, has been happening within the system of slavery since its conception. I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged. Red. I think Dr. Curry says pretty regularly. That's one of the aspects that is regularly glossed over in the way that we think about rape and who can be raped in the system of racism, white supremacy, not thinking of black males as being victims of rape and not thinking of white women, women in general, but particularly white women as perpetrators of rape and sexual violence against black males. Others with commentary, questions that they wanted to share, line should be open. Feel free. I will give folks a chance in case they are not in an area where they can speak. Again, the question that I asked, if or do we think black misandry may be impacting how black boys specifically are being parented, raised, if folks have thoughts on that. Again, I do not have children. Some of the notes that I took from the second audio segment. I feel like I've heard conversation, and Dr. Curry's been here a bunch of times since 2012. Might have been a conversation with him. But I feel like I had or heard dialogue where someone else said, hey, Rachel Gentile said that, you know, he could be a pedophile. Like, why is that not taken serious? Why couldn't Trayvon Martin have been fearful that, you know, there was some sort of sexual predator out to get him? I feel like I've heard that conversation before on this program even. But I definitely feel like I've heard it before. He said in the text that there hadn't been a blog or an article or anything to take up that possibility. And I guess I'm saying maybe I don't think that that's accurate. If folks run through your mental, your memory, if you recall such a dialogue or article or anything else. The report that he brought out from January 2013 about the two white women and two white men that killed Eric Glover and Terrence Rankin and surfed on top of their bodies and then had a threesome on their corpses. I mean, who could even make up such a thing? The crazy thing is I do remember that case. I do remember talking about it on this very program. I think we played one of the news clips talking about it on the compensatory call-in. Dr. Curry talked about it on the program. I do remember talking about it repeatedly, but I mean, who would he? And I mean, again, this is not ancient history. This is not something that happened, you know, way back 1910, 1810, 2013. This is a couple months before the Trayvon Martin, Trayvon Martin trial for the murder of Trayvon Martin. But I don't think that's a case that gets discussed at all. Like, I don't think people, if you mention that case, I don't think most people be like, oh yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I remember that. That changed my whole outlook and made me reevaluate what I think. I don't think that is the case at all. That should be a case that should be household name, a household known entity to every black person, especially any black person in Illinois. Amen. Let's see. Oh, yeah. This is an important one as well. He says, in short, the erotic nature of black male death is denied to maintain the stability of our disciplinary categories. Academics, scholars, and policymakers find comfort in alienating the homoeroticism and sexual fetishization of black male flesh. In doing so, racism remains an accident among civilized societies rather than the barbaric sexual lust whites have for the anal penetration and castration of the black male body. Sizzle, Dr. Curry. Now, I would take a passage like that and say, now, all of the folks who say they think this book is written for white people, we think that was written for a white audience, really. All righty. But I do think super, super, super important. And I see that manifested so many ways. And I think that that is important because some aspects of pattern recognition, Dr. Welsing talked about that on a regular basis. And this misconduct, particularly the sexual abuse, anal rape, the castration, all of these rituals of sexual violence against Black males need to be thought of not as anomalies, but this is a central, a crucial aspect of white supremacy culture. I think that that is extremely important so that you can categorize these events correctly, so that the incident in North Carolina that we talked about with Dr. Curry, where they were putting hot sauce on the genitals of Black males, that can be understood correctly, not as an aberration. Oh, that's just, you know, wacky. I don't know what that is. Those guys are just crazy. Dr. Welsing even warned against that. It's not crazy. That's not just wacky. That's not a couple of bad apples, as they say. This is an integral aspect of racism, white supremacy, being mad. A lot of this reminds me of Dr. Welsing, fear and anxiety about black genetic material and being focused on the genital area. Lots of that reminding me of the ISIS papers theory of white genetic annihilation. Next. Let me snag red. This is one. She says racism thingifies Black life, and the reduction of Black men and boys to the event of their dying leaves the aim of racism accepting the racially oppressed as not human, nothing lost, unquestioned, making the suffering of Black men and boys a second thought, weighing it as less valuable because it is so common, saying maybe he should not have died, but is not a statement affirming the lives of Black males. Absolutely. If anything, that is, I would say that is the essence of dehumanizing. Maybe he shouldn't have died, but probably was going to go to jail anyway, probably was feverish anyway, probably would have mugged and raped a white woman anyway. Very, very common sentiment in the system of white supremacy. Sometimes almost said exactly. And in fact, sometimes they skip all of that. They don't even do the maybe he shouldn't have died. It just gets to, I'm not protesting. I'm not saying anything because niggers is no good anyway. Continuing. Let's see. Really important sentence here as well, I thought. He says, the white man's fear of Black men does not impede his excitement or the stiffening of his penis in his murderous encounters with Black men and boys. I know a lot of times we talk about, is this fear or is it just an excuse to kill Black people? And I just go back anytime that I think of whites and fear, I think of white genetic annihilation. That is the only fear in the system of racism, white supremacy. They are not trembling about niggers. It is white genetic annihilation, and this absolutely does not impede their enjoyment and practice of terrorism against Black people, for sure. Let's see. Oh, man. I shared this on social media earlier in the day. We had a listener who was talking about the text. I'm not going to read the whole big paragraph because it has so much great information. But just towards the end, he says, the white man who murders the Black man attempts to be man in all capital letters. What does Dr. Welsing say? The man, since he has shown the superiority of being the white mind over the Black male body, killing black men is an attempt to reduce the number of Black phalluses that can cause white men anxiety and worry. The death of Black men arrests the yearning white men have for their flesh and phallus. They remove the penis to signify their domination of the Black male body, thus making him a lifeless corpse and not man. Great passage, in my view. And again, theory of white genetic annihilation. Dr. Francis Press,
Dr. Francis Cress Welsing's work, I think, right here. I said this reminded me a lot of Mr. Fuller, a lot of Dr. Welsing in reading the text. It might be interesting to get Dr. Curry's thoughts to see if, you know, he sees the same overlap in terms of Dr. Welsing's theory about why white people practice racism, white supremacy, and saying the same thing, why she says so much of this is focused on the black male, why is, you know, so much of the police violence is focused on the black male, so the lynching and the castration, why are they doing that? Why? She talked about that all the time. Why? Seems to be a tremendous amount of overlap, I'd say, especially in the portions that we read this week. I will stop there, although I did have other portions highlighted. Yeah, I can stop right there. If other folks had any other comments, questions that they want to make sure they get in.
May I be heard?
Red in Nevada.
To answer your question about if black misandry kind of affects the rearing of black male children, just from my observation from my family members, I think it does. I know frequently I hear that boys are a lot easier to raise, and I don't know if maybe that also translates into somewhat of neglect and providing more attention to black females. I know I've seen examples of it. And then also even observing recently with other situations outside of my family, where black males within black young boys, even within, like, you know, the school system here, being, I guess, in a roundabout way accused of, you know, being rapists, you know, interacting with young suspected white racist females. So definitely even, you know, constantly see that even in 2018. But I don't know if maybe that kind of, with the black misandry, if maybe that like corresponds with how people seem to think that raising black males are easier, even though they might also to one understand that it society may treat black males a little bit harsher than black females. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. I did mention a listener posted a report right in sequence with our topic for today. Washington, D.C. to settle lawsuit with ice cream vendor who was targeted by cops because he is black and subjected to repeated invasive anal probes by cops during weapons search. The nation's capital is settling a lawsuit with a black man who accused a police officer with the Metropolitan Police Department of repeatedly probing his anal cavity during a weapons search. The American Civil Liberties Union, D.C., announced last week that Washington admits no wrongdoing and will pay an undisclosed amount to M.B. Cottenham. The ACLU and 40-year-old Cottenham sued police in July over the September 2017 search by Officer Sean LoJacono, LoJacono, of the Maryland Police Department, who denies inappropriately touching Cottenham. Cottenham claims he was targeted because he is black, and they have extensive video footage of this entire interaction, showing him spread eagle and grabbing at his genitals, almost in the way that Baldwin described in Going to Meet the man. Cottenham, an ice cream vendor, had been discussing his birthday plans on that day with his friends when two police cars arrived on the scene, according to the ACLU. The thought that kept running across my mind is, they're going to kill you. So I thought about teddy bears being put up on the tree or becoming hashtag. I'm like, so not funny, but that's exactly what I said. Is so tacky and insincere that you can predict, you already know what's going to happen. They'll hashtag my name and they'll have t-shirts and teddy bears and they'll come out and roll around on the ground and, oh, Mr. Cottenham, we're so sorry. And I mean, I laugh because it's cliche. We haven't, but we just do this every week. We just get together and put the teddy bear exactly as he said. I'm not going to read any more of it, but I mean, that's exactly why I do not follow the police incidents and all of that, because it's the same thing every time.
No resolution. You just see all of these family members mourning their lost one, and people do the hashtags and T-shirts and teddy bears. Maybe they stomp around in the street. Maybe they don't. The officer is not charged even most of the time, much less convicted. And they get, you know, how many hundreds of thousands from crowdsourcing or what have you, because we're so sad and want to make sure they have security and they're stable, the killer, that is. And then we just move forward. I mean, it's laugh as though we have some sort of real, we're really actually sad about what happened to Mr. Cottenham or Eric Garner. Sad about what happened to Eric Garner when they had video, they had a news reporter out reporting on his death, and they had white people behind her mocking his death, pretending, oh, let's pretend we're going to choke. Remember, he got choked out. They were pretending and giggling up a storm right behind her when they're reporting, oh, it's so tragic, we lost. That right there. Tackiness. We don't really have any concern. We'll talk in yads and don't even want to talk too much, as Dr. Curry has emphasized repeatedly. Let's not even hear too much about them. Let's, you know, talk about more worthy victims. Did other folks, any final thoughts or questions that they wanted to share? Dr. Curry, the man not.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I think I wanted to just bring up something also that the Mr. Demery Ford mentioned also, is just, and which will be interesting to look up, is the aspect of the rape, the porn industry and the correlation, and who's actually watching those so-called interracial videos, and how those videos are so successful. I think that it'll be interesting to have a conversation. I apologize, I don't remember the professor's name that came and actually was on the show and interviewed and brought this to light. I believe that she was doing a documentary as well. I think you might have mentioned it a prior week, but I think it'd be interesting to even have her on at one point in Junction to actually just to give an opinion on this. It will be really interesting to see her perspective based on some of Dr. Curry's work as well. That being said, page 148, I think this was a very good point he mentioned here. While our accounts of violence in the academy range from marginalization to silencing, sexual violence has been reserved only for imagining we have rape. Baldwin suggests this is much too limiting. The white man learns of himself through death of the nigger. And that's a connection again, just with death and black males is just, it's so constant. And even Baldwin saw it from back then. I mean, I can only imagine how many other people during that time understood this strange dynamic of the black male and death. Also, the next one, which is a good one, I thought that was pretty relevant, as, and this is 150 in the middle, as a white man, he is enabled by reason to fuck a white woman like a nigger to satisfy what she craves without raping. Again, this goes back to what Mr. Demery Ford mentioned earlier, again, about this. I think this is one of the only ways that they fuel themselves. This is, it's almost like we are not just, I guess it goes back to the word fungibility. We are like a strange resource to them in some sick, twisted way. In reading this, I got to admit, this is a difficult passage to keep reading, and the lynchings after a while are a little bit difficult to digest, a little tough thing to go to sleep with, and have to read something else after this. That being said, I will mute my line. Thank you.
It is not the most pleasant book. Absolutely. I agree 1,000%, but we are not in pleasant circumstances. And I would add, I've had a lot of trouble sleeping way before I got to the man not, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of Black manhood. But I certainly feel you, sir. Any other questions, thoughts? If you want to respond to the question about how does Black misandry, or if it does at all, impact how Black boys are parented, reared, let me know. I am intrigued by that. Just thinking about it as we have been reading this here week. Again, we should have about three or four more sessions to go. And if people, if you do not understand the text, certainly if you're only listening, I would think it's going to be substantially more challenging because there are a lot of difficult words and the phrasing of it that I think it would be helpful to actually have the text so you can follow along to help you process the information. But it is a challenging read, as is the ISIS papers, as is Urugu, some of the other books that I think are absolute gems, but they're also, you know, not the easiest of books. You might have to read them several times. So just put that there. And again, I am certain, I know some listeners have taken me up on this or taken Dr. Curry up on this. I think he would be willing to help if you say, hey, we're reading it on the cows, or you even, you know, bypass that Gus is, you know, whatever victim. But hey, reading your book and I didn't understand such and such and such and such. I don't understand this term. Or I don't understand this phrasing. Help me out. Or this is what I think it is. Am I, you know, processing? Am I getting it correctly? And I'm sure he'd be willing to write back and give you a thought or two. Or you can save it. We get him back on the program. Bam, you should have a ready-made question. Read your book and I did not understand. But be proactive. This is something that could be done like today, because you could email him today and maybe get a response in the next 24 hours. So be proactive. If you're reading, I think there's a lot of constructive info in the text, I think, that will help you get an accurate understanding of racism, white supremacy, and some of the things that are not discussed, and to help you process, make sense out of some of the patterns that reoccur in the system of white supremacy, the fondling of Black males. That even came up in Chicago with John Burge and the terrorism, them taking prods to the genitals of Black males. That comes up over and over and over and over and over. Electrical, even in South Africa, when they would do a so-called apartheid, electrical prods to the genitals of Black males. Dr. Wells, and that's the way she used to phrase it, connecting the dots. I think this book can do a lot in terms of helping you connect some of the dots that are not even seen sometimes with why whites are behaving the way that they do in relation to Black people. With that, we'll be here tomorrow, Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And we'll be here Saturday, Compensatory Call-In, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Email if you have thoughts, questions, gripes, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged for all those who participated, tuned in. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. War is being waged against Black people. Let's do all that we can to preserve our brain computers so that we can make quality decisions, helpfully keep ourselves as safe as possible under extraordinarily dangerous conditions. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can. I mentioned his name, Daniel Holtzclaw. Let's do all that we can to minimize any contact with enforcement officers. We have heard a lot of ugly incidents about what happens to the genitals of Black males and Black females when in contact with enforcement officials. Let's try to not be in that number. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out.
Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.